Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Targeted Talks. I'm your host, Jordan Sava. In this episode, Dr. James Foran, Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic, delves into the presentation and diagnosis of BPDCN. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Foran. To start, would you introduce yourself to our audience?
Right now.
Yeah, my name is James Foran. I'm a professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic. I work in Jacksonville, Florida, on the Florida campus. I am the chair of the Acute Leukemia and Myeloid Neoplasm Disease Group in the Mayo Comprehensive Cancer Center. I focus on acute leukemia and also support our BMT program. And I work as a big focus in clinical trials, novel agents, and a lot of rare myeloid diseases.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that.
Sure. Yeah.
And to kick things off, can you tell us in your experience how a patient with BPDCN typically presents to your clinic?
Yeah, it's a rare disease and you have to really look for it or suspect it. It's an acute leukemia, so it can present as an acute leukemia. Sometimes can be mistaken for a lymphoblastic leukemia or an acute myeloid leukemia. It's not uncommon to have lymphadenopathy, skin involvement. There's sort of a characteristic kind of eschar look that you can get sometimes with the skin lesions that have a kind of a particular look. I wouldn't say it's diagnostic or pathognomonic, but very suggestive. And it's something where you really want to be working with your pathologist to recognize. I've had some that would come in and we would say, oh, I wonder if this is a BPDCN, but it wouldn't be based upon the phenotype, because there is a characteristic phenotype. But you do want to work with your pathologist also to make sure that they're looking for CD123, CD4, CD56, and some of the other associated markers for it. There's not a particular cytogenetic pattern or specific mutation pattern for this. There's some that are more characteristic of others, but you can see different mutation profiles. And what's important about the disease is that you can get extramedullary involvement, that you can get short-term responses to chemotherapy, but we seem to do better if we can guide people to transplant more quickly. And we have some targeted agents that are now FDA approved and available for this group that seem to improve outcomes.
Thank you. And just off of that, what are some of the challenges that you've encountered with diagnosing a patient with BPDCN?
Well, some of the challenges are that people are often diagnosed in the community centers. You know, most people will go to, it's funny, as a patient, the perspective is you're being sent to a specialist, you're being sent to an oncologist. A lot of high-intensity hematology is run by oncology in the country, and most hematologists have an oncology base. And so you'll have people who are well-trained, good doctors, good oncologists, but they're not seeing a lot of acute leukemia or not a high volume of it. And they'll start off at smaller centers. Their diagnostics will be done locally. Sometimes genetics will be done by a vendor or third party. And so that they won't always recognize this is a rare variant of acute leukemia when they first come in. And they'll start a therapy. They'll start an ALL induction or an AML induction therapy, sometimes low intensity treatment regimens in the community. And it often takes a while for the person to get to an academic center or a subspecialty center where we would recognize the diagnosis a little more often or review the pathology and confirm it. And so I think that's one of the biggest challenges, is just identifying the patients in real time where they live. Sometimes patients are good consumers for themselves and they'll seek out an expert leukemia opinion. Sometimes just the local oncologist does a really good job, and we collaborate with many excellent oncologists, but I think that's the biggest challenge. The second is there's often a compelling, the presence of lymphadenopathy, the possibility of CNS involvement, the presence of skin involvement can be a little confusing and unusual. And sometimes that gets in the way of a rapid diagnosis if somebody goes through biopsy, so it takes a little longer occasionally. There's often a compelling reason to start treatment sooner rather than later. And when people do that, they are often moving in with an acute leukemia regimen that is good, but not necessarily going to get the best long-term outcomes. And so I think those are the bigger challenges. I guess I could talk more about this and say that when we're starting a patient on treatment, we do bias towards targeted therapy with tegraxifusp. That's been our experience. It's still a rare disease, even for us at a regional referral center, and Mayo Clinic is actually a national referral center at our three sites. But have to admit the patient to hospital at the very beginning. And so that requires a certain degree, a certain infrastructure, access to a blood bank, the right kind of inpatient trained nurses and so on, which I think is an advantage for patients with a targeted agent like tegraxofusp targeting CD123. I say that we've candidly, I wouldn't, we don't struggle with the diagnosis particularly here, and we don't struggle excessively with initiating therapy. But in general, you want to give treatments outpatient when they can be given outpatient. You want to treat people where they live. You want to do things that are safest for them, but also not institutionalize them for weeks on end. And acute leukemia patients often spend 3 to 4 weeks in the hospital at the beginning. And tegraxofusp is one where you can continue it outpatient, but we still believe it's safest to start it in the inpatient setting. So I wouldn't call that a challenge necessarily, but really just a question of infrastructure and having access to the drug, having the resources in place, and having the people ready who know how to spell it and have used it before and know what they're monitoring for when you start off on therapy.
That's a great answer, and I'm definitely going to dive into tegraxifen a little more. But off of what you were saying with one of the challenges, given the prevalence of CNS disease and BPDCN, what is your approach to testing and treating patients with CNS involvement?
Well, it's routine for us to do that. We do it with the monocytic leukemias as well, but we'll initiate systemic therapy. We like to clear peripheral blood blasts because very commonly there's peripheral blood and very commonly bone marrow involvement with BPDCN. We would typically do a diagnostic lumbar puncture at nadir once we've cleared the peripheral blood blasts, and we would give intrathecal cytarabine when we're doing it. Now, I think it's an area of controversy about do people really need to get a full course of CNS-directed therapy? We are part of the North American BPDCN Consortium, and we did in a really nice publication, but led by Naveen Pemmaraju at MD Anderson and Dr. Lane, Andy Lane at Dana-Farber. We're part of a consensus position on standards of care and areas of need, and I think in general we're in favor of some course of CNS-directed therapy to prevent CNS involvement, but at least a diagnostic LP early on, and then strong consideration for continuing with CNS therapy as patients go through. I do think there's a role for prophylactic intrathecal chemotherapy for this.
That makes sense. Thank you for that. And with BPDCN, there are often delayed diagnosis or misdiagnoses. Is this something that you've experienced with the patients referred to you? And have you done anything to kind of streamline that process?
Yeah, we've been. I think both are true. It's an uncommon disease. It's a rare variant of acute leukemia, and not always easily recognized unless you're thinking of it and you have some experience with it. Sometimes can just look like a monocytic leukemia or a poor risk AML. Doesn't always have lymphadenopathy or skin involvement, although that's not uncommon. And we have been involved with educational programs for acute leukemia that include recognizing BPDCN and the importance of having a treatment algorithm in place to consider tegraxofusp or a venetoclax-based regimen, and really to be thinking about allogeneic transplantation sooner rather than later in the course of the disease. We do teach that you should get skin biopsy and baseline photography if you can. There's these skin eruptions or these skin lesions have kind of a violaceous look, sometimes an eschar look, and so that should be suspected in that situation. And so that's we highlight that. We certainly have that in our teaching program. And I just think awareness for the sites that would see acute leukemia and treat leukemia is key for recognizing the disease.
Definitely. And now, once that you've got that diagnosis, can you walk through kind of the rest of the testing that you'd perform?
We do a bone marrow biopsy, aspirate biopsy in everybody. We obviously a physical exam in everybody. We have a low threshold for a PET scan or a CT scan to assess for lymph nodes if there's anything accessible clinically, just so we have a baseline. We like to get skin biopsy and baseline photography in patients. We have an outstanding dermatology group. We collaborate with them on cutaneous oncology. And so they will do something called a modified severity weighted assessment tool or MSWAT score to kind of assess how much skin involvement there is. We do assess the CNS through CSF sampling. When they've cleared blasts, we don't do it when there's a lot of circulating blasts. It's not against the law to do that, but there's some theoretical reasons why it's nice to wait to clear the blasts. All patients, just like you would with any acute leukemia, you would perform cytogenetics. You would get NGS done as well. But I think including this, that like more formalized skin assessment with dermatology and considering systemic staging with imaging is an important consideration that distinguishes this, as well as what I think is a near mandate, a near mandate for at least one CSF sampling when blasts are clear. You know, we often, more often would see mutations in TET2, ASXL1, RAS, TP53. There's not a particular pattern, but that would be more common with BPDCN. You can see those with a regular AML also. That can make it a little confusing. And I think a key is to have a discussion early on and a plan early on to look for a donor and to try to position that patient where they could be a candidate for allogeneic transplant. Because really, the strength of induction therapy, whether it's Tagraxofusp or even some of the chemotherapy regimens that have been used historically before that, is to get people to transplant. I think that's really the only way to get long-term remission and possibly cure a patient with BPDCN.
That's a great answer. And do sites of disease involved or burden of disease at particular sites impact how you treat patients?
You know, you typically get a very good response to systemic therapy, TAG, chemotherapy, venetoclax-based regimens. So I would say yes, in that you're monitoring to make sure they're responding. I can't remember in the recent past using radiation, for instance, because we get good short-term systemic responses to it. So it's more just making sure you're including a before and after look that you've cleared those sites of disease. But we're using acute leukemia-based therapy, and with BPDCN, we're really leveraging the targeted approved drug, Tagraxofusp, in that situation. We have the experience of people of some patients starting with a venetoclax-based regimen, and there is an experience of getting good responses and getting patients to transplant with that also. So not a crazy thing to do. And if someone's older, this can occur in older adults too, of course. That's often started before BPDCN, or could be started before BPDCN is recognized. But if they're responding to therapy, I'd still capitalize on that with a transplant.
Makes sense. And do cytogenetics or mutational profile impact your treatment decisions?
More prognosis, to be honest with you. We don't have targeted therapies for most of the mutations you would see with a BPDCN. So it helps you get a better feel for how the disease is going to behave. It may predict for chemo resistance more often. Especially if you're seeing high-risk mutations like ASXL1 or RAS. And we like to see those clear when someone's in remission. I don't have a specific deep remission test to confirm that someone's in a remission that's negative for measurable residual disease or MRD. We're leveraging our AML platform for that. But that's an area that would be helpful in future if we get better. If there are mutations that we can in future get better, deeper remissions with and measure that, that's going to be useful. I don't think we're there yet, though. I hope we get there.
Definitely makes sense. Thank you for diving into that. And now for patients receiving Tagraxofusp, can you discuss the process for planning and administering cycle one?
It's an effective treatment. It has a unique side effect of capillary leak syndrome. And so in cycle one, we typically start people in the hospital because we often see that early on if it's going to happen. It's not inevitable that it'll happen, but seeing pleural effusion, seeing edema, seeing weight gain, seeing hypoalbuminemia are things that you have to watch for. So we really check the albumin before every dose. We will actually replace albumin before dose. You're allowed to skip a dose if you don't get the albumin into range. And it's one where you have to go day by day. You don't just write the prescription for your five for a 5-day course of Tagraxofusp, but you're making a daily decision to get that treatment in. I think that's really, really the key thing in supportive care. It's generally very manageable, but about 20% of patients can get grade 2 or grade 3 Tagraxofusp, give or take, maybe a little less than that. The drug has high response rates and really is a great bridge to transplants. So I'm trying to initiate a donor search early on, even when we're starting. But that's the key is volume status, daily weights, albumin, checking albumin before every dose, and adjusting the dose as you go through it. There is a well worked out algorithm for it. I think the label is very helpful in this regard. And the dosing is, it's a standardized dosing for it, but it matters that you're aware of capillary leak syndrome. It matters that you are prepared for it and you're monitoring for it.
Wonderful. And off of that, can you tell us about the roles of res and responsibilities of the multidisciplinary team for patients receiving this agent? How do you work with nursing, pharmacy, advanced practice providers, all that jazz?
Yeah, it takes a team. I'll just tell you a story. When we had a hurricane here in Florida, one of the hurricanes we had, I think it was 2016, I was on call. And on our hurricane protocol, at the time, only the faculty stayed in hospital overnight. Because of where I work is hurricane proof, but is in an evacuation zone, you have to stay over in the hospital. So when I stayed in the hospital, I was the hematologist covering our leukemia service, and everything went fine. It's just that I knew what needed to be done. I just didn't always know how to do it. I wasn't the one putting in the orders. I was directing a team. And I felt a little bit like Hansel and Gretel, where I was having to leave breadcrumbs for people to find where I'd gone to make sure that they were fixing my mistakes when I was messing up all the orders going in. So that's a kind of a sidebar comment, just to say that it really takes a team to look after a patient like this. And I know how to conduct that team, but it's the team who gives the care. So we have, a very good hematology oncology fellowship. We have outstanding experienced APPs in our program who are both PAs and nurse practitioners. We have them in hospital 24/7, and they're trained on this. And so we're seeing that patient twice a day when they're going through this. Our APPs are monitoring vitals really regularly. The weights are done every shift. We're getting labs really, it's every 8 hours minimum for tumor lysis syndrome and for DIC when we first start people on therapy. And we leverage our blood bank. We leverage our interventional radiologists when we come time for lumbar punctures after we've cleared blasts. And our pharmacists are heavily involved too. So all that jazz is exactly right. There is a team who is seeing that patient multiple times a day with dedicated specialized nurses, and because none of this is possible without that support. They're really the ones looking after the patient. So my hurricane comment was just to say, yeah, you don't want to let me loose in a hospital by myself during a storm. You really want the team around because I know how to manage that team, but that team is looking after the patient. And that's just a I'm old enough now to know that I need them to do it, and I need to be there helping them doing it and supervising them doing it, but they need to be doing it.
I love that. Thank you for adding that. That's a great addition to the conversation.
My goodness, they had a nurse go back and change all the orders after every patient I saw because I was accidentally discontinuing everybody's standing potassium orders and their antibiotics because I thought I knew how to do it. And so I've come a long way since then, but our team has evolved since then too, and it needed to.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah.
And I guess just when and how do you typically check for a response in patients reading tech receiving tegraxovir?
Well, people will go through a nadir. Just like you would with any patient with an acute leukemia, you would be following through a nadir, giving supportive care with antibiotics prophylactically during nadir, and also restaging with a bone marrow biopsy to ensure complete remission. We do repeat imaging for BPDCN for anybody who had baseline abnormalities and follow up with our dermatologist, and we're tracking CSF also.
Got it. And for you specifically, what has your experience been like with transplant in BPDCN? Do you see a role for autologous stem cell transplants?
I don't really. I think you need to get an allogeneic transplant to cure patients with this disease. And that's what was done, for instance, with tegraxofusp in the New England Journal publication that really drove that off of the pivotal trial. It was getting patients to transplant was a particular goal. And so we're looking for donors. We're looking for donors early on for that. I think that's really an important consideration. I don't have personal experience with autologous transplant for BPDCN, And I really don't think that's the standard of care for the disease.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It
And
has been done. I will say, in fairness, it's been done. But I think just the whole field of autologous transplant for acute leukemia has been a big enough question mark that we would really heavily bias towards allo transplant.
definitely. And to kind of close out the conversation, how do you approach relapse disease in BPDCN? Are there any roles for reutilizing therapies in later lines?
Anytime something's worked once and you got a long remission, you can go back to it. You can absolutely do that. I think the standard now with BPDCN is to move to a venetoclax-based regimen for relapse or refractory disease. There are some other targeted immunotherapies that have been looked at or that have been in development, also going after CD123. But I think typically we would go to a venetoclax-based combination therapy and be trying to leverage transplants again in that situation or maintain a maintenance. I have to say that I've never, I don't want to say this, but I will say it. I don't think I've ever cured a person with a relapsed BPDCN. That's a very hard thing. And that situation, you're trying to get control, improve quality of life, looking for long-term remission if you can get it. I know it's theoretically possible to get a long-term, or I'll say the word cure, but I really feel in that situation, you're fighting a different battle about control and then trying to balance patient goals. And achieve the best you can, knowing you're unlikely to cure that person second time around.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And those were really all wonderful and comprehensive answers. So thank you for taking the time to speak with me and share your insights. But is there anything else that I missed or anything else that you would like to touch upon?
No, your questions were constructed with knowledge of the disease. I feel like you're asking the right questions. And I feel with this disease, it matters you suspect it. Knowing you're looking after CD123, CD4, CD56, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 is sort of a helpful thing. Having a high degree of suspicion if there's lymphadenopathy or skin involvement with violaceous skin involvement, I've seen eschar also. And having an awareness that you really should look at the CNS. That's not always standard with acute myeloid leukemia, it is with ALL. Some people historically have used ALL regimens, but and had good results if they get them to transplant, but we really think you should suspect the diagnosis early, try and get somebody to a targeted therapy, and look for a donor.